Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. If it feels like there's a little less space to walk around on this planet of ours these days, well, it's not your imagination. There are a lot more of us here than there used to be. The world population crossed the 7 billion threshold last year, and all indications are that population growth will continue. Some believe we can't sustain the population on the planet now, but what's another 2 billion people between friends? Tomorrow, Andrew Revkin, Senior Fellow for Environmental Understanding at Pace University and the Dot Earth blogger for the New York Times, will give a lecture presented by the Prairie Research Institute, home of the State Scientific Surveys at the University of Illinois, exploring what it might mean to have 9 billion people on this planet later this century. In advance of Wednesday's lecture, we thought we'd take the opportunity to speak with Mr. Revkin about his views on this finite planet of ours. Before joining Pace in 2010, Andrew Revkin spent a quarter of a century writing about science and the environment. More than half of that time, he did so for the New York Times, for whom he continues to write the Dot Earth blog, which examines efforts to balance human affairs with the planet's limits. Andrew Revkin, welcome to Focus.
It's good to be with you.
Glad to have you with us. As we hear Andrew's views on population and resources and talk about some other things, including how science is viewed around the world today and the special challenges of science and environmental reporting, we welcome you to the conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL or 800-222-9455. WILL. We also welcome your questions on our Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. So, Andrew, by 2050 or so, the human population is projected to reach about 9 billion. What does that mean for the resources on our planet?
Well, it means a lot of pressure on resources, for sure, and particularly in places where most of the population growth is going to come. That's the thing that gets missed sometimes. The old 20th century notion of the problem of population pressure was that it was a global bomb. You know, Paul Ehrlich's book, The Population Bomb, kind of implied there would be global breakdowns. Every economy would be impacted by this. But what I wrote in, on the blog, one of my first posts 5 years ago was on the reality that it's more like a population cluster bomb, meaning there's little spots in the world, Lagos, Nigeria, for example, where you have high fertility rates, high concentrations of people, huge resource pressures, and all the other issues that come when you have dense populations and not a lot of wealth. And then the flip side is places like the United States, where population is growing at a much faster rate than in other developed countries, although it's most of it's through immigration, you know, a million or so people a year. And then you're an American, whether you're born here or you come here, is a sort of a super emitter. You travel longer distances for work, you live in a bigger house, your energy appetite is bigger. So that's another impact as well.
Can we sustain 9 billion people, recognizing that we are ultimately talking about these sort of clusters, these pockets where there's incredibly dense population? Can that density be sustainable?
Well, the flip side of density is cities can be a real boon for the environment because of the efficiencies that come with city living. If it's a city like New York, like, you know, Manhattan particularly is the ultimate example of an incredibly efficient machine where because you share wall spaces with other people, there's a lot less energy use per building. There's transportation options. There's more efficient use of water. You're not watering lawns and all that stuff. So city living can be the salvation of the human species as we go through this transition the next few decades. And in fact, as a lot of readers and listeners probably know, you know, we went through this transition right around now. The last couple of years, the human species became a mainly urban animal for the first time in its existence. We've been very mostly rural, dispersed, and now we mostly live in towns or cities. And that has reduced our impact on the environment. The other thing is agriculture. With industrialization of agriculture, it comes with lots of issues, but it also can be a boon to nature. If you're growing more stuff on the same amount of acreage, then you're not taking down forests to grow more stuff.
You mentioned this rural to urban shift, and you were talking about that 20th century notion of population being one sort of big pile of people and a problem worldwide. There were just about 3 billion of us back in 1960. So we have added roughly a billion people every 13 or 14 years since. How else, besides this sort of rural to urban shift, is the planet different today from 1960 simply because there are that many more people on it?
Well, one of the biggest changes in that span particularly is the depletion of ocean resources. The great high on the food chain fish species like tunas and sharks have seen declines in their total biomass in the oceans of something like 80%. And it's not as if we've run out because we just go farther to get more of them. But that's been a profound change. We wrote some stories for the Times years ago when I was still on staff about the emptied oceans. And it's kind of stunning. And it's sort of weird because you can still go to the supermarket and buy one of those little cans of tuna, unremarkably, but the oceans have been just transformed. So that's one thing. The others would be, you've seen kind of different trends, like in the northeastern states of the United States in the late 20th century, through the 20th century, were reforested. And they're actually, another Times reporter wrote a story not long ago on this. There are similar things even in some parts of Latin America where people have, through urbanization and intensification of agriculture, are seeing land that was agricultural revert to nature. So it's not as if that's what's sort of encouraging. We've gone through this growth spurt so far, and a lot of the sort of 1960s era warnings of apocalypse did not play out because of things like agricultural productivity, getting more production per hectare. We were able to feed ourselves without stripping the planet bare. And of course, there are issues that are building, like the greenhouse influence of humanity is there. It's not there in a way that you can see tangibly year by year because it's an uneven. The heating of the planet doesn't play out in climate change in a straight line. But those issues are still with us, but there's a sense that we can, with some care, can manage this transition through 2050 and beyond and come out the other end with thriving species on a functioning planet.
Can we separate the number of people on the planet from the changing climate of the planet, or are the two intrinsically linked?
Well, they're linked in two different ways. One thing about the population cluster bombs I was talking about a few minutes ago is a lot of that growth in populations, the high fertility rates, the most tend to be poorest populations in really vulnerable areas like sub-Saharan Africa, where climate risk for centuries, for millennia, is such that it's an area prone to super droughts and flooding rains and that kind of thing. And you're sort of doubling the population between now and 2050 in an area that's already vulnerable to climate extremes today. And adding on to that whatever is coming through the building greenhouse effect, which is complicated enough that you can't really know how that's going to play out, what parts of that part of Africa are going to get drier or wetter. But so there you're seeing the climate still affects us. Even as we're slowly affecting climate, the dominant story is still climate affects us, which is, of course, what we saw in the Midwest here this year was an extraordinary drought and persistent heat, similar to 1988 and back through into the 1930s. Climate matters.
you mentioned that sort of alarmist perspective that people held in the mid-20th century about, the population will grow so much to the point where we'll just, resources will be depleted and we won't be able to survive. Mm-hmm. There are some who feel that the views about climate change are similarly alarmist, that 30 years from now, 50 years from now, we'll look back and say, things weren't as dire as we said they were.
Well, and that's because climate change, the projections for what's going to happen on this greenhouse heated planet are uncertain. They're implicitly uncertain. And it could be that we'll end up on the low end and that a lot of people will then look back and say, boy, that was much ado about nothing. But what gets forgotten is that the uncertainty plays in both directions, in the sense that if you're not hedging against the risk that things could end up worse than we thought, and that right now there are natural cycles that are actually not just natural cycles, but other kinds of pollution that are blunting the warming that's in the pipeline, sort of masking it such that when things shift in the other direction in a few decades, it'll be way hotter and way more damaging than the mid-range projection. That has to be accounted for as well. And so that's why I think what happened in the mid-2000s, and I wrote about this at the time, was there was too much of a downplaying of the implicit uncertainty. So there were too many advocates for change who were kind of implying that, oh, we know it all now. It's a crisis that's unfolding now. The heat wave around you at this point is our fault. That rhetoric, I think, was damaging because it didn't account for the reality that this is a gamble, and that we have to find policies that are robust enough to account for things going in the better direction or the worst direction, and that science is not going to. Some of these uncertainties have been robust now for decades. Like, essentially, how warm is it going to get from a certain buildup of greenhouse gases? That remains a very big question. We still don't know whether it'll be on the sort of 2-degree end globally or the 6-degree end globally. It's most likely going to be in the mushy middle. But there's been some. That's been like that for decades, literally. The first scientists who articulated the greenhouse warming risk kind of roughly calculated, almost like back of a napkin calculation, and that hasn't changed, even with billions of dollars of climate models, running around the clock to try to figure it out. So that's the thing that I think there was some overstatement for sure, and that the reality is it's. But you can also overstate that. Oh no, things are going to be fine.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking with Andrew Revkin, Senior Fellow for Environmental Understanding at Pace University. He's the Dot Earth blogger for the New York Times, and he spent a quarter of a century reporting on science and the environment, much of that time for the New York Times. He'll give a lecture at the Ellis Campbell Alumni Center tomorrow at 4. It's free and open to the public, presented by the Prairie Research Institute, home of the State Scientific Surveys at the University of Illinois. We're discussing some of what he'll talk about tomorrow. We're also going to get into how science is perceived in the world today and the state of science and environmental reporting. And we welcome your questions and comments for Andrew Revkin at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL. 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. Andrew, how do you feel in general people around the world view scientists and scientific research today?
Oh, boy.
It's a big question.
Yeah, science is a field that's an endeavor that's not really well understood, unfortunately. And part of it has to do with how we're taught. This is here domestically, and part of it has to do with how people perceive risk generally, and then look at science to sort of support their risk views. But realistically, there's still a big chunk of America that puts religious beliefs in front of science, and believes that humans got started on the world 6,000 years ago.
Do you feel that any major misunderstandings about science really are ultimately linked to people's religious views, or is that just one piece of the
puzzle? Oh, I think it's just one piece of things. And keep in mind, the Catholic Church accepts the basic tenets of evolution. You can find ways to mesh religious understanding with scientific understanding. There's such different ways of looking at the world. But for some of us, predispositions, science can kind of threaten your sense of your comfort zones for how the world works, and that can be problematic. And this is true not just in religious arena, but think about people's reactions to nuclear power or genetically modified foods or trace chemicals in our bodies from exposure to industrial activity. The science on many of these arenas points to no danger I'm not going to. It's, you know, we could spend an hour talking about any one of those things, but but our reactions tend to be flavored literally by things that are not a function of rational thought. They're more about our emotions and our reactions. So we're set up as a species almost to sort of put emotions ahead of data, and that's a problem. And unless you sort of understand that, find a way to kind of understand that your reaction, whether you're liberal or libertarian or highly religious or an atheist, there are things that come before in how you react to information, especially about things that are threatening, like, you know, a potential source of risk. The data comes second, not first.
Let's talk about a specific example. Just this week, six Italian scientists were sentenced to 6 years in prison for what a judge said was a faulty forecast of a 2009 earthquake. Essentially, some tremors had been felt in this town, L'Aquila. A local man, not a scientist, predicted a large earthquake. The scientists characterized a major earthquake as improbable, and then it turns out, well, there was an earthquake, and more than 300 people died. You called this prosecution of these scientists sometime, I think, last year, a quote, medieval-style attack on science. What did you mean by that?
Well, that essentially it's blaming science to a certain extent for failing to handle a prediction, failing to tell society what it wants to know, which is, what do these tremors mean? Now, there were failures by those scientists. If you look, I have a piece that just went up on Dot Earth yesterday about the latest jailing, you know, the conviction after last year's piece was about the trial, and it's more subtle than just that they were, you know, failed to predict their quake. They really mishandled their communication effort. But it's also crystal clear that a big chunk of the death and destruction that happened had nothing to do with the failure to predict the earthquake. It had to do with the fact that there were very shoddily constructed buildings in L'Aquila, and I don't see a rush to jail the lax inspectors and the contractors who built these structures. You know, it's so ironic. I did a piece when the earthquake happened that showed that young buildings fell in an old city. The old buildings stayed up. They were built to a standard.
Yeah.
Understanding that was a place in Italy that had you had to build a building strongly, and it's the new stuff that fell down. So a lot of this was just scapegoating, which is not really about science particularly. And the scientists didn't do an ideal job, but clearly the idea of sending scientists to prison, even if they had flubbed their risk communication effort, just seems to me to be outrageous.
I'm curious if you think that there, I mean, you know, setting aside the fact that there will always be some folks who will look askance at scientific research and results or question science in some way because it maybe points to something that doesn't reflect their worldview. That aside, do you feel like there's been some sort of backlash in some corners of the world against science just very recently, in recent years?
Well, I think what you've seen is, particularly on climate in America, there was a real powerful effort to raise questions about the body of research pointing to human influence on climate change. And some of it was completely over the top and agenda-driven and related to the agenda of a very small sector of America, the kind of the real hard right. And that spilled out in a way that was really unfortunate. And it kind of distracted from the reality that, as I said, you know, a few years ago, I think there were overstatements and there was some overplaying of the global warming problem. But to have a cogent discussion about that as opposed to just bomb throwing would be great, but it doesn't seem we're capable of that with our polarized politics and communication.
Well, just to give an example, can you talk a little bit about some of the reporting you did back in 2005 and 2006, which uncovered some efforts by political operatives in the Bush White House to sort of, in essence, rewrite government climate reports?
Well, there you had, what I wrote about was this pattern to try to, the Bush administration was tamping down within government output, within government reports, and particularly at NASA, anything that related to findings pointing to a human impact on climate change or that it was a problem. And that was really just old-fashioned. If you're running a big institution like a government, you do what you can to make sure it's hewing to your message of the day or your message of the term. And this was clearly an overreach in the sense that NASA, particularly its mandate, and it's NASA was chartered by Congress in 1958, and it's the only government agency that is mandated to communicate its findings to the public. That's part of NASA's charter. And to sort of say, thou shalt not communicate to an agency whose job in part was to communicate was really scandalous.
Is there a way to effectively separate scientific discovery from political debate over the implications of what researchers find, or are they just ultimately going to be linked?
Well, when science becomes, the phrase is policy relevant, it's really hard to disentangle the two, partially because scientists are human beings too, and they have both. You end up with these cycles in science where, like within climate, where the focus is on the stuff that supports the trend of the moment. There always will be scientists who push back or are trying to challenge the ideas of the day, but overall you end up with kind of a torquing toward a momentum that can, even within the peer review process, can kind of let work go forward that's flawed. So that can kind of end up creating what I call a whiplash effect, whether it's in journalism or in the science itself. And by the way, that isn't just in climate or environmental research. You see this in diet. You know, mm-hmm. Is fat? Should you have a fat Atkins diet or the opposite? You know, these patterns tend to play out. And what happens when you get those big sloshy kind of waves within science or within the communication of science, it ends up actually disengaging the public and raising skepticism about the value of science generally. So it can be self-defeating in a way that I think I've seen play out a few times.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Andrew Revkin, the former science and environmental reporter for the New York Times. These days, he writes the .Earth blog for the Times, and he's a senior fellow for environmental understanding at Pace University. Tomorrow, he'll give a free lecture on the U of I campus entitled 9 Billion People Plus One Earth Equals, well, question mark. Details are on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. We welcome your questions and comments about population growth, climate change, and science and environmental reporting at 333-9455. Or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's go first this morning to Mark in Arcola. Hi, Mark.
Hello. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Great. My question dealt with water and the population explosion. You know, if we got another 2 billion people on the planet, surely just walking around with water in them is probably 100 billion extra liters, plus they consume 2 to 4 extra liters of billion liters of potable water. What could our guests say about that in the future?
Well, water is, water is one of the keystone limiting factors on human activities. We need it to grow our food. We need it for sanitation, obviously to drink, and in a changing climate, particularly, you end up with having to have, and as I said, with unpredictability. Even for the United States, there's still some uncertainty in the models on where it's going to get wetter or drier, and in which seasons, how much will come in extreme downpours. So being able to manage water in uncertain conditions. Oh, by the way, another, water relates largely to our energy options, whether it's hydro or or cooling a power plant that requires river water. There was several times in the United States recently where droughts forced cutbacks in power production because the plants couldn't keep cool. And so finding ways, whether you're in Sudan or the Midwest, to deal with too much water and not enough, to sort of smooth out those to develop the resilience to have enough water around or to use it more efficiently so that you don't have to worry so much is an imperative in a century where we're, you know, clearly appetites, again, resource appetites are growing. Now, the United States has already demonstrated industry here and agriculture have gotten far more efficient using water than they were a century ago. So when you look at it on a sort of per unit of gross national product, the water use has gone way down. So we're good at it, but there's much more that can be done.
Let's go next to Paul in Champaign County. Good morning, Paul.
Hi. I was moved to call about global warming and something that's very rarely talked about. In fact, I had the irony of watching a documentary from the BBC online some years ago, and they talked a lot about ocean acidification and a comparable NOVA program around the same time didn't mention it at all. And I was befuddled at the time, and I still am. It seems to me that the fact that the oceans act as a carbon sink and, perhaps people think that, well, that's fine, but it's actually it's kind of lethal to a lot of things in the ocean, particularly when it gets to 30% more than it has been in the past. Yeah. But you also gave the example of sort of settled science, nuclear power and GMOs, both of which I think, can be questioned in a very, very scientific way. It seems GMOs just haven't had the longitudinal studies and the highly, interactive unintended consequence kind of studies, a la the precautionary principle. And that's why Europeans are skeptical, I think, it seems to me. I don't think it can be discounted as some emotional reaction, personally. Nuclear power, there's recently a speaker here who says, that, from the Union of Concerned Scientists, who says that they've run numbers that to their mind, indicate that nuclear power, the subsidy of nuclear power, has never been paid back, quote unquote. There's been more subsidy of nuclear power than the energy that's gotten out of it. It's been a net loss in those terms, which is pretty astonishing. It seems to me that you then have to look at the political dimensions of why we're talking about a nuclear renaissance with the questionable organizations such as Shaw Group. Now called Chicago Bridge and Iron. I'm just hoping some people would Google those companies because they're supposed to be bringing us the nuclear renaissance in this country. So I have an appointment shortly, so I'll
right.
listen.
Right,
thanks, they're good points. Although the issue with all of our energy choices, just to focus on energy for a second, is none are perfect and all come with trade-offs. There's even fights over solar panels and desert tortoises in the Southwest. And if you love wind power, you better like transmission lines because you have to. When you have a distributed power supplies like that, you have to have ways to move it to into the grid, and that can create all kinds of issues. A lot of people who love birds hate wind turbines as well. And with nuclear power, we're kind of stuck now with half-century-old reactors that were essentially they're overgrown nuclear submarine power plants that. And there are other designs that now it's pretty clear can be that are self-limiting reactions. There are ways to manage fuel that the country is slowly shifting toward. But again, there's no, I live 8 miles away from Indian Point nuclear power plant up the Hudson River from New York City. And my wife and I, she feels it should be shut down now. I feel it should be run as responsibly as possible, as long as possible, because there's the options are to burn more coal. And if you want the status quo, that means a lot of coal, and that comes with known mortality issues. Talk about precaution. We're killing thousands of people in this country routinely every year through exposure to pollution from coal-fired power plants, especially here in places like the Midwest, and don't bat an eyelash about that. And so I think you're right that it's important to do a full cost accounting for all of these issues, but it has to be an honest and open one so that you can really say, well, if not this, then what?
We haven't found the energy silver bullet yet.
No, and it is clearly, this is, as Bill McKibben says, a silver buckshot kind of issue where you're not going to find one silver bullet. I just wrote on the blog last week a couple pieces about fusion, which is that eternal silver bullet, Hail Mary pass kind of energy revolution that is always 20 years from now. And even in terms of where we invest money for research, there comes a time when the debate arises about how much do we put into fusion versus advancing solar and photovoltaic efficiency, that kind of
thing. Right.
And we're always going to be stuck with those issues of how to the trade-offs.
In a way, it seems like maybe eventually the debate could shift just towards percentages. All right, how do we tick up this percentage and tick down this percentage of our energy from this resource or that resource?
And there are people who are working out analyses of those sorts, splitting the climate problem into quote-unquote wedges, as one research group did. You know, how much can you get from more efficient cars? How much can you get from, if you did want to move to nuclear power, how would that play out? How long would it take to build enough nuclear power plants to avoid 1 billion tons a year of carbon dioxide from coal, that kind of thing? And they're good exercises because they reveal the scope of the challenge. And also, you know, they help us to figure out priorities. Another one, of course, is conservation, which has just been, there's a paper coming out later this week from a group laying out the underinvestment we do in conservation, energy conservation research. In other words, finding new ways to do that.
Well, the perception that I've heard some have regarding conservation is that if it is easy, at least in terms of conservation related to consumers, if it is easy and requires no additional effort or no specific, process beyond your everyday habits, then a conservation policy can work.
Mm-hmm.
But if there is extra effort required, people are still, you'll walk only so far to put a plastic bottle in a recycling bin.
Right. No, it's true. Although, what the upside, though, is that people have identified simple things that can make a difference, like how you design a utility bill visually. If you have a clear-cut way to show that your power use is pretty high for people like you, higher than the average, that the smiley face icons and little things to catch attention can actually make a difference and get people to be more actively engaged in conservation.
I remember there was an effort some years back. Somebody came up with an online quick survey that indicated to you how big of a carbon footprint you were providing on the planet, how many Earths it would take if everyone had the same habits you had.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's maybe another way that can sort of clarify those questions.
Although on that front, Frank, they have found that sort of a chiding, finger-wagging approach doesn't work.
Yeah. We're discussing the implications of a growing population on our finite planet, as well as other matters, scientific and environmental, with Andrew Revkin. He's Senior Fellow for Environmental Understanding at Pace University, the .Earth blogger for the New York Times, and he spent a quarter of a century reporting on science and the environment, much of that time with the New York Times. To join our conversation, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll take more of your phone calls and emails for Andrew Revkin after a short break. This is Focus.
In the early days of the Iraq War, Marines fired on a family in three cars that didn't heed their warning to stop or turn around. Three members of the family were killed. On the next Fresh Air, one of the Marines, Lou Lobello, tells us how he was haunted by the experience and recently managed to locate and meet two survivors with the help of reporter Dexter Filkins, who will also join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the 4th Annual Champaign-Urbana Folk and Roots Festival, November 2nd and 3rd in downtown Urbana, with over 70 artists performing blues, jazz, old-time, Cajun, bluegrass, and Irish music. The festival also features storytelling, Saturday workshops, and family activities. Schedules and information at cufolkandroots.org.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. My guest is Andrew Revkin, the longtime science and environmental reporter for the New York Times. He left that role behind in 2010 when he became senior fellow for environmental understanding at Pace University. He's also remained affiliated with the Times as its .Earth blogger. Tomorrow, Andrew will give a free lecture open to the public at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center here on the U of I campus about world population and resources. There are details about his lecture on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. To join our conversation, you can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL, or email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. Next up is Steve in Eureka. Hi, Steve.
Hi. A very interesting program. I was reminded when I was in college in about 1970 or 71 that I became very caught up in Paul Ehrlich's thought about the population explosion. I believe he wrote a book about that. Did I understand you to say that you thought that Paul Ehrlich's predictions were overly pessimistic in terms of the Earth's ability to match resources with increasing population growth?
Oh, yeah, yeah. His predictions failed, at least a number of them. Now, there are some who say he just got the time scale wrong, that it's just a slow-motion process, that we're still overextended and nature will bite back. But when you look at agricultural productivity, for example, which was one of the factors that he predicted would fall behind, it's just pretty clear that the ingenuity of farmers, particularly American farmers, but around the world, has allowed extraordinary increases in yield to be sustained year after year of 1 or 2%. And that has outpaced not only just the basic numbers, but also our appetites have grown larger than just the number of people, you know, people getting into middle class. There's an explosion of the middle class around the world, you know, the number of people who have more than enough money, essentially, to get by. And that tends to shift our appetites toward meat and, you know, up the meat chain from the most efficient things like fish, poultry, up through pork and then through to beef, which is the least efficient in terms of resources per pound of stuff. And but so far, again, we've kept up. Now, by 2050, I've done pieces on Dot Earth where even the most aggressively techno-optimistic types say the diet of the prosperous won't be in 2050 won't be the diet of the prosperous today. You know, the 22-ounce porterhouse steak and stuff. You can't have that big a middle class and that kind of resource appetite. But again, we'll see.
Do you see an optimal population that the Earth could sustain based on, as you were talking about, growing trends by increasing middle classes around the world, such as in Brazil and China and Russia and other places?
Well, you know, that's an open question. And there's the best book on this issue by far. It's a technical book. It was written by Joel Cohen of Rockefeller University many years ago, and it's called How Many People Can the Earth Support? And it's a question because it all relates to what kind of world we want. And in other words, there's clearly the capacity to have many more people on the planet than we have now. But will there be room left over for rainforests and coral reefs? And will we have to move aggressively to desalinate water, which is totally doable? It takes a lot of energy, so how do you get the energy for that?
Plus, does everyone want 11 roommates?
Well, yeah, although Edward O. Wilson, E. O. Wilson, one of the great environmental thinkers of our time, calculated, I can't remember how many billion, whether it was the current population of 7, but he said essentially on a square footage basis, you could, all of the 7 billion people could fit into a tiny little part of the Grand Canyon if you stack them. You know, so we don't. When you look on an average basis, look at Canada. There's only 30 million people in Canada. There's something like 30 million. And they have such vast terrain, so you could see much room for a lot more people.
I guess if we were all in the Grand Canyon, that would at least cut down on commute time. But
it would, yeah. So it's an interesting, you know, basically it's an open question, how many people can the Earth support. There are a lot of projections going forward toward 2200 that have us sort of settling in at a kind of 3 billion very happy people living comfortable lives, living long lives. Oh, by the way, that's the other factor is, you know, as we live longer lives, our resource footprint gets bigger through your cumulative resource footprint. And you can see this even in terms of healthcare costs. You know.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Yeah, and of course, the other problem is that every three or four stacks of people in the Grand Canyon, there'd be another Starbucks. So,
oh, my God. That's an interesting thought.
Next up is Ken in Champaign. Hi, Ken.
Hi. You know, the science has certainly shown that crop rotation is a very good thing. But I don't see that happening, and then we have the issue of pesticides and herbicides, and probably there's a little more science in that regard, but there's been such an overuse of it. So you have a comment on that, and then I have one other issue after that.
Okay.
I'm not sure I understood. Crop rotation.
Well, what I'm getting at is that,
be a good thing.
You know, with a monoculture, it's corn, corn, corn.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
What happens is that you talk about stress.
Yeah,
and what happens? We have more pesticides, herbicides, and certainly we know that that's not. You know, there are some that certainly can, in terms of cancer, it has the possibilities and all that kind of stuff. You know, so
yep.
A comment on that.
Well, yeah, and this gets, you know, one thing I've written about on Dot Earth is repeatedly is the reality that we're going to see a hybrid future in agriculture, where in some places for some crops there are some chemicals that need to be used, and fertilizer is an incredible boon. And if you want to go to an old manure system, you still have to graze those cattle somewhere to generate the manure to foster or nurture the organic crop, and that has to be factored into the impacts of that organic crop. So, you know, it's not so simple to say, well, we moved away from industrial-style fertilizers to manure, we'll all be happy. There's trade-offs everywhere. And I've been to Iowa and seen the plots there, the experimental plots that Iowa State does, that show you a rotational approach can really grow a lot of corn. But again, you have to look at the full life cycle impacts. It would be great to see some of those practices spread further. And but there are crops that will always be better done in a kind of industrial way to get the maximum efficiency. And clearly efficiency matters. You know, you don't want to be wasting.
Well, there's too much overspraying. I mean,
no, you don't want everything running down into the Gulf of Mexico. And
yeah, well, that's an issue I'd forgotten about. The other one is that in terms of the research, in terms of fear appeal or fear, what happens is, you know, a certain level of fear motivates people. Unfortunately, I think when it came to global warming, is that, you know, it was over the top, and you know, now there's a new documentary in terms of the ice, how much is being, you know, that's coming out. But, I mean, this, I think what happens eventually, if you hit that level, and all of a sudden then people just turn off. So.
Right, and, well, I've kind of written pieces for years warning about the overuse of the fear factor. I wrote a story for The Times back in 2006. The title was Yelling Fire on a Hot Planet. It's easy to Google for, just Google for Revkin and Hot Planet. And it, essentially, I talk to social scientists who say, you know, you can yell, be worried at people for hours, but it's not going to make them worry. It's very hard to impose concern on people. You can provide information and provide sort of a menu of alternative actions and build, the concern has to build within the person, though you can't sort of impose it. And I think that got lost. A number of my friends in the environmental movement just were so frustrated with the inaction on things like greenhouse gases that they thought if you just sort of ramp up the discourse more and more that might get people's attention, but it doesn't work that way.
If they hadn't taken off the solar panels off the White House, it would have been a different day.
Yeah, I've written about that too, the effort to put them back on. And they're not there yet, even under Obama.
Ken, thanks very much for that call. Let's go next to Lewis in Chicago. Lewis.
Yes, good morning. I was going to ask about the health and environmental side effects of contraceptives. People talk about the dangers of overpopulation and, you know, that type of thing and the water supply, but I don't think they realize that, for instance, the World Health Organization lists birth control pills as among the most dangerous drugs in terms of causing cancer and the hormones from contraceptives to get into the water supply, they can't get them out, so, you know, kind of destroying our water supply, and what does your guest think about that?
It's fascinating to see. There have been studies that show essentially, I did a post on this a couple of years ago, what was the title? We Are What We Drink, We Are What We Drink, What We Are. In other words, the stuff that, so much of a drug that we take goes down the toilet and it ends up in the pond nearby or in the water supply, affecting the behavior of fish, the sort of the biochemistry of the physiology of fish and amphibians and stuff. It's quite remarkable when you see what can go out from that. Human impact is significant in that sense. And on the other front, in terms of how that kicks back to vulnerability of people's own health, those are separate issues that I haven't really focused on as much, you know, whether certain contraceptives are more apt to cause cancer or whatever. That's not really my terrain.
But I guess another thing to mention briefly about contraception in relation to population is that there are some nations on Earth where that access to it doesn't exist, and there are those who argue that if the access did exist, that it would lead to better control of population.
Oh, yeah. Well, there, I've written a lot about access to family planning. And it's clear that in many parts of the world, there's what demographers call unmet need. In other words, a lot of the pushback against family planning programs was from people who implied that this was all being forced on women. And there were unfortunate instances in India and other places a long time ago of fertility forced for, sterilization programs and stuff. But nearly all of the efforts these days are just filling an unmet need. You know, there are women who would love to have access to contraceptives or just to basic information on how to manage your fertility who don't. And if you fill that gap, you can, in these places in the world that are sort of what I call population cluster bombs, you know, where you do have high fertility rates, high exposure to disease, huge problems with botched abortions, that kind of thing. By just having access to information and materials, you can have women and families be more the way they want to be. So it's a way to give more freedom to women, not to impose things on them.
We only have a few minutes left, and I wanted to ask you if you had any observations about the state of science reporting today.
It's a very challenging time. There's some great things happening. Science blogs, just Google for that phrase, science blogs, and you'll see some wonderful stuff going on. A lot of it's unpaid. Some of it's by scientists who also have a gene for communication. Some of it's by journalists who are trying new tools. But at the same time, you know, the number of reporters out there writing about things like climate change or energy choices or health, not so much health. Health journalism is still a growth industry, but in every other arena, it's being eaten away by the revolution on the web as journalism faces competition. There's opportunities. Having experienced people being able to dissect tough sciences, that model is going away. At the same time, though, this is a great opportunity for institutions like the University of Illinois and NASA and NOAA, the agencies of science, to be telling their own story, to provide direct outlets to the public of what they're learning about science. So it's a changing landscape. The bottom line, though, as I've written before and said, is that journalism is a shrinking pie out of an explosively growing pie of ways to share and shape ideas. And that's a mixed bag. It's sad for the norms of journalism. It's very exciting in other ways.
Well, one of the pressures of media today is a need or a desire to report more in less time. And that seems to sort of run counter to what you really need to do to effectively report on scientific research.
Yeah, unfortunately, all the pressures in the newsroom are cut the wrong way, but we'll just have to figure out a way forward. You know,
is that one of the reasons you decided to sort of step aside after so many years of reporting?
Yeah, to some extent. I've done the drill of reporting breaking news so many times, whether it was 9/11 or a plane crash off Long Island in the 90s, or energy policy stuff that I covered, or disasters and earthquakes. That stuff you get physically tired of, but I do find that there are ways to foster understanding of issues that I care about that are not within the realm called journalism, and that's what led me to this hybrid life where I'm still blogging every day at the Times. Today was my 2000th post on Dot Earth. 5 years anniversary comes tomorrow when I'm in Illinois.
Congratulations.
And it's an experiment, and I think it gets around some of the roadblocks that I was frustrated with. But I'm also teaching. I'm teaching blogging and how to make a compelling video and how to communicate environmental science at Pace University, and it's wonderful to see the lights come on in students, too.
Andrew Revkin is a senior fellow for environmental understanding at Pace University and the Dot Earth blogger for the New York Times, where he reported for many years on science and the environment. He'll give a lecture presented by the Prairie Research Institute, home of the state scientific surveys at the U of I, tomorrow at 4 at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center at 601 South Lincoln Avenue in Urbana. The lecture is free and open to the public. There are more details on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. You can also call 333-5111. For more information. Andrew, thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. Again, that's will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, this August marked the 100th anniversary of the birth of Julia Child. We'll talk about Julia Child's remarkable life with journalist Bob Spitz. He spent some time with her in the early 1990s. Their conversations about food form the basis of his new book, Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child. That's on tomorrow's Focus. Today's show was produced by Travis Stanzel. Kyle Mabry's our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.